Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is our neighbor from Pittsburgh, sort of, from Chatham, northern Chatham County, Ruth Moose, retired after 15 years on the creative writing faculty at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and before that, a just highly regarded poet, short story writer, and teacher all over North Carolina. Late in life, she discovered a novel that she'd written when she was younger, pulled it out, worked on it, and it became an award-winning novel. And we've talked about that. Set in a town called Littleboro. Some people would think it's like Pittsburgh. Some people would think it might be another small North Carolina Sandhills or Piedmont town. Now there's a sequel called Wedding Bell Blues. Ruth Moose, welcome.
Thank you.
What do you say about your new book, Wedding Bell Blues, and how it fits into the into your career?
Well, the Since Dixie Dew had been written, 25 years ago, and when it won the Malice Domestic Award from St. Martin's Press, and they published it, and I had to go, they asked me when they called to tell me this had won, they said, "Is this part of a series?" And I said, "Oh, yes."
You made a decision on the spot that it was.
Sure. So I had to pull up these people again, these characters. And I didn't know if I could do it, but I think I did. And
well, tell us about setting of both books is the same place, and the major character is the same. So tell us about this little town of Littleboro, the returning daughter of the town.
The prodigal daughter.
The prodigal daughter comes back and takes an old family house and turns it into a bed and breakfast. Tell us about Beth McKenzie.
Where to start? Well, she is completely imaginary, and the town is imaginary. Somehow, when my husband and I were living in the Uaris, if we went to Raleigh, we went through Carthage, and Carthage has a courthouse in the middle, and there's a lot of old houses there, and I just sort of appropriated one of the houses to fix up in my mind and become this bed and breakfast. And so after the book was accepted, I realized I didn't have the name of the town in there, nowhere. And Jane Dunlap, who is my computer right arm, I said, "What am I going to call this place?" And she said, "Call it Littleboro." So she named the town.
So this is in the rewrite. 25 years later, you had to patch it up a little bit.
Yeah, I didn't do that much to it, but there was, little places that my editor had written in the margin.
Well, some people might not know much about Carthage or Pittsburgh or wherever else you might be accused of setting this. But tell us about Littleboro. What's it? Where in North Carolina is it located?
And well,
how big is it? What are its features? Does it have a movie theater?
Have a movie theater. It just has a little downtown. The courthouse is in the middle. There's a statue of a Confederate soldier. And the people read the Pilot newspaper.
That's the Southern Pines paper.
Yep.
So that it is Carthage.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of. And but I've always read the Pilot. I used to do book reviews for them. And when Selm Regan was the editor and publisher. And so I've always loved the Pilot. And but the town of Littleboro is, people thought it was Pittsburgh. And so in Wedding Bell Blues, I deliberately put in some Pittsburgh things. I used the fairgrounds and as the setting for the green bean cook-off.
Well, go back. I do want to get to that, but go back and tell us more about the town well, other people would think it was Pittsburgh because you do have a courthouse there. And kind of, I don't want to say it's extraneous to the book, but the courthouse happens to burn down. You have a little adventure, side adventure of the main consequence there being no jail after the courthouse burns down. but so this is a place? What's the racial makeup of this little town that you made?
Well, okay, in the first book, Beth's best friend is a pharmacist who just happens to be African American. And it's so funny, when 27 years ago when I was writing this, I was living in the Uaris on a 900-acre mountain. We didn't own but 3 acres of it, but I was the only house there. And my husband had bought me a K-Pro, and he said, now write your novel, because he knows, you know, I would retype and revise. I'd never get a novel written without a computer. And this used the big floppies. Do you remember those?
I do.
Well, anyway, I was sitting there at this K-Pro, and there was a small window up above me. And I looked up in that window, and I saw Melinda. I saw her with the big hoop earrings, her hair on top of her head, bright, wonderful, beautiful. And so I began to write. And my husband came in. He was teaching at Stanley Community College then, and he came in, and I went running, and I said, oh, the most wonderful thing happened today. I saw Melinda. And I described, you know, the window and everything, and he said, I don't like to hear you talk like this.
Why? What did he mean?
Well, there was nobody else on that mountain but me.
So this is a vision, and your husband was worried about you.
Yeah. It's imagination. Imagination's always hard to explain to people.
But Melinda never became the absolute main character of your book.
She's more in Wedding Bell Blues, but Beth needed a best friend. And so in Wedding Bell Blues, I talk about their lockers being side by side in the high school. Yeah.
Which would have been during the times that the schools were being desegregated.
Yeah, right. And so Melinda was one of the first, and her mother was an educator. And I don't know really what Melinda's doing back in Littleboro. She's a single mother, and she and her mother are raising this little boy named Elvis. And so I don't know her background, but I knew in the first book I needed somebody who knew pharmacy, and in the second book, she's the one who knows what's going
on.
Pills. And what was so funny, I mean, people ask where you get ideas, but there was a trashin' show over at Frank, the gallery here on Franklin Street. And I didn't know what it was, but it was clothes made out of throwaway things.
Bottle tops.
And
so this idea came from Chapel Hill.
Right.
And now, I just have to tell you, I missed the Frank's Trashathon.
Oh,
and
well.
Vaguely in memory, but now it's an important part of your book. Why?
Yeah.
Because of the character is
Melinda. Because Melinda is tall and stately and beautiful, and so she has more a part in Wedding Bell Blues.
Well, you're leaving out telling us all about Beth McKenzie, the owner of the bed and breakfast, which is struggling to be financially successful, and she's struggling to kind of find her place in life. Tell us about her and why you pick her to be your character and narrator.
Well, I'll have to tell you, the original first draft was written in third person. And somewhere, I tinkered with this book over the years.
You're talking about the first book now.
The first book. The thing about teaching, you have the summers off, and it takes you a couple of weeks to get all your students' manuscripts out of your head. And then you have a couple of weeks to work on your own stuff before you have to start doing the syllabus for the next semester. So every summer I would pull this up and I would tinker with it. And Talmadge converted it to a Dell. So it was on a Dell of the little disc.
Your typing device.
Yeah, but that's exactly what I use it for, as a typing device. And but I would tinker with it, and at some point I changed it to first person, and I guess I got closer to the character of Beth. But I still don't really know that much about. I knew she went to the Rhode Island School of Design. She's sort of an artist, and there's a part in Dixie Dew where she has to defend herself with an X-Acto knife. I mean, my gosh! And so I was married to an artist, and so I know a little bit about art.
So Beth is sort of a character modeled to a small degree on your late husband.
No, not as a character, but some of the tools he used, like an X-Acto knife. And
in these books, it's not really critical that Beth be an artist. She's a struggling businesswoman.
But she has taught art. Okay, she went to the Rhode Island School of Design because her grandmother says, you know, packing all these wool sweaters, said if you'd gone to school in Atlanta, you know, we wouldn't have had to buy all this. You could save enough on your tuition with all these wool sweaters if you went to school in the South.
I'm visiting with Ruth Moose. We're talking about her latest book, latest novel, Wedding Bell Blues, and she and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Ruth Moose. If you joined us late, she's a retired faculty member from the writing department at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in creative writing. She's teaching down at the community college in Pittsburgh now in retirement. And other projects include writing novels, something she's gotten involved in deeply since her retirement, except that you're the first – your first of two books was really in large part written many years ago and has been revised.
Yeah.
So we've agreed that Beth McKenzie is your lead character and your narrator. Well, now tell us what happens. what is this book about?
The first one or the second one?
We're talking about the second book.
The second one. Okay. One of the things about writing a murder mystery is there has to be a murder and there has to be threats and that kind of thing. And I joined a group called Sisters in Crime, and because Karen Pullen, who lives in Farrington Village, started this group, and I joined to support Karen, had no interest in it, and remembered this novel that I had tucked away a long time ago, because Doris Betts said, if you want to learn to plot, read mysteries and write a mystery. Because I always had trouble with plot. I mean,
tell us about the struggle for plot in this one, if you want to tell us about Beth.
Well, you probably know as much about her as I do.
The people listening don't know a thing about her.
But they have to read.
What's important for them to know? What would excite them in order to get excited enough to find out more in the book?
I think the town of Littleboro is a character. And like you said, the town of Pittsburgh, the courthouse burned down. And people say, where do you get your ideas? My gosh, they're everywhere. All you have to do is just be aware. You know, like the trash and show. When I went, I had no idea I would use it. And then it came in this draft. But anyway, what I was going to tell you, I went to the beach with five writing women. These were mystery writers. And somewhere in there, I thought, gosh, I need to pull that thing up, that old novel, and see what it looks like. So it was converted to a Mac. Jane Dunlap converted it to a Mac for me. And what's amazing is converting it from computer to computer, and it wasn't lost. And so I was able to submit it.
Well, I still want you to tell me about the new book.
Okay.
And what this is a murder mystery. Who got killed, and what did Beth have to do with it?
Well, they happen in her bed and breakfast. That's the big thing. You know,
well, in the first book, but now in this book, you got a mystery person dying.
Also Debbie Moose dies. Do you read Debbie Moose's food column?
She does die, but let's start. Can you start at the beginning and tell us what happened? If you forgot, did you read this book?
Not recently.
Well, let me tell you that there is an interesting opening, and that you have a unidentified person dying, and you have an identified crazy person, homeless person, who is in love, supposedly, possibly with this. And how does Beth get involved in this?
Okay. Well, okay, the opening book, the opening chapter, and editors say you've got to grab the reader. They used to say with the first chapter.
That's a great, how did you grab the reader?
All right, read the first line of that. Crazy Reba, who's a homeless character, and people swear she lives in Pittsburgh. She calls Beth on the phone, and Beth has no idea what a street person got a cell phone. I mean, Crazy Reba. So Crazy Reba says, "I've killed him." And Beth says, "Who? Who?" And Crazy Reba says, "I've killed God." And so Beth says, "Where are you?" And she's at a place called Motel 3. So Beth goes to rescue Crazy Reba, and the policeman, Ossie, is there arresting her. And
he's arresting her because she's sort of confessed.
Yeah, she says, "I killed him."
Well, now, is he dead?
We don't know. You have to read to find out.
Well, this is in the first three pages.
You think he's dead because she thinks he killed him, but you find out later, he dies later. One of the speakers at a Sisters in Crime meeting, this was an EMT guy, and he says the EMT does not haul bodies, they haul people. But if it's a body, they call an undertaker. I didn't know that, so I had to change my whole thing.
You had to bring the undertaker into this, but so somebody's dead. A crazy person confesses. It's pretty clear that this person doesn't have the capability to do so. What's the mystery?
Well, the mystery is, who is he, and who killed him? Did Crazy Reba really kill him?
Tell us how he got the name God.
Well, I don't want to give it away.
Okay. You better give away some of it or nobody will be interested in it.
Well, one time in New England, my husband always had to make a pilgrimage to Stockbridge, Massachusetts, because that's where Norman Rockwell lived and painted. And so this was kind of a pilgrimage, and there's a Norman Rockwell Museum and all this stuff. And one time we were coming back or something, and I saw this white van, and it had on the side like 15-foot letters, G.O. D. And I thought, God, that is so
God's
fun.
God's truck.
God's truck.
Well, what was it?
I had to use it. Well, it was General Overnight Delivery. It said that in real small letters underneath. And I read years later that they made that company change their logo. Evidently, some people, it bothered them.
Why did Crazy Reba think that she killed this guy who she called God? Why did she? What did she?
Well,
she
had done to him? He had passed out, I suppose, so she just thought he was dead.
And the policeman believed her, or did he? Why did he bring her, haul her in?
Well, because she was saying that, and he knew there was something going on. And
well, what does Beth have to do with this?
Crazy Reba's a friend of hers, and she's got to rescue her. She's a rescuing kind of person. And Crazy Reba's in jail. And it was a way to get Beth involved, I think, because she goes to there's a key. When Ossie's hauling Reba away, Beth picks up Reba's cell phone, and there's a key with it, a motel key, and that's to Motel 3. And it's so funny. People think there's a motel in Pittsburgh that's being refurbished, redone, whatever, but it's pretty decrepit right now, and people think that's Motel 3.
Well, is it?
No.
Well, where did you get the idea from Motel 3?
There was a motel in Albemarle that it was really shady. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, so you don't really have, you know, we don't think that this guy really was murdered. He looks like he's just a dead corpse.
Yeah.
So why do we have a murder mystery? And what does Beth have to do?
Well, that was what my editor said. I wrote the first draft in about six months. I would sit down every morning and laugh and laugh and laugh. at some of the crazy things these people were doing.
In your book?
In the book. Yeah, in the book, because there's a rabbit named Robert Redford, and Robert Redford goes missing. And then some friends of mine in Farington have a pet turtle named Nadine. My editor said I had everything in this book but a mystery.
Well, that was the question I was going to ask, but now tell us, if you won't tell us about Nadine in the book, tell us about Nadine the turtle, in the real turtle who inspired the character.
Okay. She's two people who go to University Presbyterian Church, and they live in Farington, and they've had Nadine for 30 years, and she's in their will. Because
she's just a little box turtle?
Little box turtle. Yeah, just a cute one.
Let me just tell you that I thought that this description of a pet turtle was absolutely unbelievable, and I was going to jump all over you about that. You're telling me it's in real life.
Yeah.
And does the turtle understand what they're talking about?
She seems to. She's a smart turtle. I mean, if you meet her, she watches TV, and she loves golf.
How can you love? What do you mean? Golf on TV.
Golf on TV, yeah. But anyway, Betty Lou Cobb and her daughter, Ann Lise, had been after me for years. When are you going to put Nadine in a book? And so I wanted to put Nadine in, and I was trying to figure out a way to do it.
Well, I don't think this is giving away anything critical, but give away how you use Nadine with one of your minor characters to show the ridiculousness of this character. Can you want to talk about that? The party where Nadine.
The party. Okay. Well, I've got to explain. When I was writing, I needed a food judge, and I called Debbie Moose, and we're not kin because Moose is her maiden name, whereas Moose is my married name, but we know each other, and we keep in touch with each other. So I just picked up the phone, and I called her, and I said, can I use you in my new book? And she said, oh, that would be fun.
But you didn't call her Debbie Moose.
Wait a minute.
Okay.
And I said, can I kill you? And so she was quiet for a few minutes. And then she said, on one condition, you make me a beautiful corpse. And so I changed her name to Debbie Booth because she said that a lot of people think that's her name anyway. But anyway, when she is murdered, I gave her a funeral bigger than Elizabeth Edwards. I mean, they were lined up down Edenton Street, and the mourners and vendors were selling Kleenex boxes of Kleenex. So I was really nervous about.
So this is a real tribute to your friend Debbie Moose, whose work you admire, and you gave her a fictional funeral in the context of a character in your book. And is this character a critical character in your book?
Yeah. She's one of the food judges. She's critical.
I have no reason on the basis of what you told me today to know why you've even got a food judge in there.
Well, there's a green bean festival in the town of Littleboro, and I actually looked it up, and it's somewhere in Alabama. There's a town that has a green bean festival. Wikipedia is great, but Stanley County, people there always said if there was one thing that grew well, it was green beans. So I combine all this stuff. I mean, that's what art is. It's combining things. It's a patchwork quilt.
And so your Debbie Moose character, Debbie Booth, enters the novel because there is a food festival going on in this town.
Yeah.
Which has nothing to do
with the murder.
With the murder.
No, but she gets it. But sort of by accident.
She dies, but is she murdered?
Not really. It was kind of an accident. She just ate the wrong thing. And I have judged with Debbie in a couple of food competitions.
Uh-huh,
and,
uh-huh.
You know, it's kind of dangerous.
Listen, I'm running over time. I'm visiting with our neighbor from northern Chatham County, Ruth Moose, talking about her second novel, Wedding Bell Blues, the second murder mystery. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Ruth Moose. We're talking about her second murder mystery. And just if you did join us late, Ruth Moose has a great reputation in the writing community as a poet, as a writer of fantastic set of short stories. She is not known either as a novel writer or certainly not as a mystery writer, or at least hadn't been until about 3 or 4 years ago. She won an award for a novel which was largely written many years ago, and that has led to a second novel that we're talking about now, Wedding Bell Blues. And for a lot of people, this idea of bed and breakfast, you know, running to bed and breakfast and getting to know everybody and having your own home, being able to live in your own home and still make some money, is a dream that often, or more often than not, doesn't come true. But why did you choose to? Are you just living fictionally, or have you had experiences?
I got a North Carolina Writers Fellowship 25 years ago, and I knew what I wanted to do. I went on a literary pilgrimage of England, and we stayed in bed and breakfast all over England. So that's where I got the idea. And I also, somewhere, I had told myself, if you ever write a novel, if you set it in a bed and breakfast, you've got a lot of suspects.
Oh, yeah.
Because you've got people coming and going. And my cousin in Asheville said that she made a note. She started reading the first one, Dixie Dew, and she made a note of all the characters who were suspect. I never thought about anybody doing that. I just wanted to, you know, have a lot of people.
Everybody could be a suspect. Well, yeah. And this one, you don't pack your bed and breakfast with suspects.
No.
You develop a kind of mysterious suspect who comes out of the motel or maybe from out of town.
Appears. Yeah.
And you call her Mrs. Butch Rigsby. Tell us about Mrs. Butch Rigsby, where she came from and what her purpose is in this
book. Well, her husband's missing, and so she comes to find him, and he's in
Little Girl.
What we know is that he's a sort of a truck driver. He drives, and
he drives the God truck.
And he stops maybe in various towns and develops a set of girlfriends, but is this woman is just mad with. Because she thinks he's got. Why does she think he's got a connection here, or in Littleboro, your town?
She has tracked him down or something, and she thinks for a little while that Beth is the one he's involved in. See, that adds some more to it. I'm not great on plot. I just really have characters and situations going on, and. When I sent in the first draft, like I said, I wrote it in 6 months. And I laughed and laughed and laughed. And after I sent it off, I got up the next morning and my house felt empty.
Sent your baby away.
No, it felt like I had given a big party. And there was music and there was people and wonderful food. It was just the most wonderful party. And everybody had gone home.
So
then I got St. Martin's. I didn't hear from him for 5 months. Writing a novel is just a lot of your eggs in one basket. And so when I finally heard, I got this 3-page single-spaced letter, and she said she loved all this, but she says there's no mystery. And I was going to have to rewrite, completely rewrite. And so I just had a tantrum. I literally had a tantrum and said, I'm not going to do that. And
what did you think? Did you think she wasn't right? Did you think you did have a plot? Or did you say, I didn't even set out to write about it? I set out to write about these wonderful characters.
That's exactly what I did. And I had a good time doing it. And she said, it's wonderful, but it's not a mystery. And what they did, they published mysteries. And the readers want mysteries. And they want a murder. And so a friend of mine, this is in the acknowledgments, I was not going to revise it. I don't know what I was going to do with it, but I wasn't going to revise it. And I was going to return the advance for one thing.
No, not really now.
Yeah, I really was. I really was. I was so, I didn't want to go in and have to totally redo it. But a friend of mine who, her bumper sticker, her car license plate says Ms. Mystery. And that's all she reads are mysteries. And she said, she gave me two words of good advice. She said, grow up.
And what she was trying to say is, Ruth, they're right. You need to, if you want this to be a mystery, you've got to have a better product.
And she just said, you've wanted a New York publisher. This is your New York publisher. Now work with them. And I sat down.
I guess they were just kind of breaking you in like a horse.
Yeah.
And so you're broken and you agree that you, so how, what did you do to this set of funny stories about interesting characters to make it into a mystery? What was the first thing you did?
Oh, gosh.
What is the first thing you decided that you would do?
Well, I went back in it and tried in each chapter to add something, some mysterious element to it. So the chapter ends and you want the reader to turn the page. Mm-hmm. And so I did a lot of that. Plus, the editor had told me, this is one reason I was kicking and screaming, it was 60,000 words. Dixie Dew had been 60,000 words. My editor said, this book has to be 80,000 words.
So you had to add content to it.
She said, go back and look at your contract. I never read that contract.
The contract said it had,
said it had to be 80,
about approximately 80,000 words.
But so, you know, it was like writing a third.
You know, that's interesting, Ruth. I hadn't focused on this challenge that you face because, you know, usually those of us who like to write, the message is really that's good, but we don't have enough space for that.
Yeah.
Can you you have to kill all your good characters and ideas. And this one was, we like what you've written, add some mystery, and put in some more stuff.
Yeah.
That's a challenge.
Yeah, it was, because I'm used to writing short stories and poetry, and I write really tight. And so every word was just a struggle. And I had to add another character, and I think in the original, I may not have had the Pittsburgh Courthouse Fire, and I had to put that in, and I threw in everything I could think of.
Well, this explains a lot to me.
Does
I,
it?
You know, well, I didn't want to be critical, but I love the description of the Pittsburgh-like county fair, but I had a tough time seeing that it was an integral part of the plotting device, and now you just confess. I just threw that in there to get my 80,000 words. Not really. I'm just teasing you.
I put a lot of stuff in there just to get up my word count.
All right. Well, we're doing just the opposite. We've gone over our minute limit for this segment, so we're going to take a quick break, and I'll be right back with Ruth Moose as we talk about her new book, Wedding Bell Blues. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is our friend and our neighbor, Ruth Moose. She lives south of Chapel Hill in Chatham County, but she goes to church in Chapel Hill at a Presbyterian church, and therefore she has a Presbyterian minister as a character, and he's not altogether a wonderful character. I mean, he's got some flaws, and his wife is not all that perfect, is it? What were you doing?
No resemblance. Absolutely no resemblance. But I did tell Marla Durham, I said, when it comes out, and if anybody asks you if that the minister's wife is you, the minister's wife is tall and thin and blonde, and her name is Barbie. And Marla says, I'm going to tell him it's me.
Was the Presbyterian minister one of these things that you used to increase the word, increase your words, or was this an essential character from the beginning?
He was in the first book.
And what's his, you had lots of, I mean, there are more churches in this town, little town.
Uh-huh.
But what is, I mean, you killed off Catholic priests and everything. You did bad things more in the first book than you did. What role does the Presbyterian minister play in this murder mystery? You want to make him a suspect?
No, I didn't want to make him a suspect, but maybe he's sanity because there's so much crazy going on. And so he's stability and sanity and and just he's really a nice guy. There's other Presbyterian references. If you read carefully, you'll see symbols of the descending dove, and you'll see all kinds of Presbyterian symbols.
Well, those we share those with other other religious groups. But yeah, that's I was glad to see that an old. You were a Methodist, weren't you?
Your
granddaddy was a Baptist minister.
My granddaddy was a Baptist minister, and my first writing experience is watching him write a sermon, and he got up and left the room, and I picked up this leaky old ink pen and wrote all over his sermon.
And
I didn't get spanked. But that was
Were you mischievous or were you just exploring?
I wanted to write.
You wanted to write, and you messed up his sermon.
And I messed up his sermon.
That's well, in any event, thanks for bringing the Presbyterian connection in there. There's another character that I was interested in, and now I can't remember her name, but she was the mayor. Mayor Moss, is that right? Mary
Moss.
Mayor Moss.
Yeah, Callista Moss, yeah.
She was a surprise character for me because I didn't, but since we don't have much time, I'll just tell you what I was going to get you to tell me. But she's somebody who knew this little town like Carthage or Pittsburgh, and she's rich. She's married to a rich,
yeah.
dashing guy. And so she wants to be prominent. She restores a house
yeah.
and runs for mayor and gets elected
yeah.
because nobody else is running. But who are you thinking about? I mean, this character rang true to me, but
good.
I didn't know where in the world.
Okay. There was a woman who lived in.
Oh, and she's nice looking.
She's beautiful.
Yeah.
And dresses. Oh, she's always beautifully dressed. People think Cindy Perry, who is the current mayor of Pittsburgh, that this character's based on her. But
did she move in from out of town?
No, I don't think so. But there was a woman, a really good friend, who lived in Farington Village, who has moved to Carolina Meadows. But her name was Callista Moss. And she was so good. Anytime I published a poem or a story or anything anywhere, she would always write me a note or call me
so
or something.
So what's the deal? You named her this after a real person, and she's happy.
Yeah, she loved it.
And did she like being a sophisticated, sort of ambitious, good-looking woman?
Uh-huh, so, she liked that. She read parts of it. She read the luncheon scene, and which was my favorite scene.
Well, so those who were listening earlier know that we were talking about a turtle.
Yeah.
And so she's the owner of a turtle. All of these things with your friends, you're teasing them and making fun of them.
No, they love it. I ask their permission first. And that, like I said, Betty Lou had said all these years, when are you going to put Nadine in a book? And so I had to have her in a centerpiece at a luncheon
for
22
people. Yeah, but you also had to make – this is funny because you had to put Nadine in, you had to show how ridiculous it is to have a turtle like this. And you make the owner of the turtle – kind of a weirdo for having this pet turtle.
No, not really. Somebody told me when they read the book, maybe it was a reviewer. This book got reviewed all over the place. She said that she really didn't like the mayor. She was too polished and too rich and everything until she picked up the turtle.
Oh, that humanized her.
And she said to the turtle, she held her to her chest and said, "Don't be afraid."
Well, see, it's funny how you get different reactions to these kinds of scenes because I thought, that's just ridiculous. But this opened the door for another reader to like the character
mm-hmm.
because of the human spirit by being so nice to an animal.
You would be, since I wrote that turtle.
A reptile-type turtle.
No. There are several people who have pet turtles.
I'm open to learning about them now, but we've got just a minute or two more. And Ruth, how's the success and the having a major publisher publish two murder mysteries? How's that changed your life? You might be much richer now.
I'm richer in friends and fans, and I feel good having done it because the revision on the second book, my editor said I can get 90 manuscripts, or 99 manuscripts, and they'll say this happened and this happened and this happened, and they have no heart. And she said, yours are all heart. So I had to go back and, you know, put in mystery and stuff.
That made it easier for you to follow the direction that she gave you that you didn't like. Well, what you going to do now? You going to do another one?
I don't know. I've got some ideas, and I would love to. I'd love to do more Pittsburgh, because in this one I have the Phoenix Bakery, which is downtown. It's real. I have the S&T Soda Shop, which is real. It's just there's so much that I'd love to put in another book. But short stories are my first love. And so St. Andrews University Press is going to bring out a book of short stories called Going to Graceland.
I can't wait. Thanks for telling us about your double book, but mainly about Wedding Bell Blues, your latest murder mystery book, and for sharing with us some of the things that we might look for. Thanks, Ruth Moose.
Enjoyed it.
And thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.